There's an interesting place in the book of Ezekiel where we have an opportunity to peek into God's mind in a different way. That different way is we get an opportunity to see people that God considers to be extremely special. Context isn't the most enjoyable. He says, when the time comes that I bring absolute total chaos to this earth, and I start holding everybody accountable for their deeds and their actions, he says, everyone will have to stand accountable for his or her own actions. And then he uses this illustration. He says, and even if, and he names three men. Now his purpose for naming these three men are, they are used as the epitome of righteousness. He says, and even if these three men were here, even with all of their righteousness, they would not be able to spare their own children. In other words, I can't even say I have such admiration for you that I'll cut your children some slack. But you know what God does in this particular place in Ezekiel is he allows us to see three individuals that he considers to be extremely noble human beings, extremely fine human beings. Now, you know, by the time we get to Ezekiel, we're at the end of the Old Testament period, so obviously Ezekiel had to pick from everyone, from Adam and Eve, all the way up to the time of Judah's captivity. Now, some of you know who those three people are, and some of you don't. And so for those of you who don't know whose names are there, let me just ask you the question. If God put you in the position to pick the three most noble people in the Old Testament, who would you pick? Well, a lot of good names there to pick from, aren't there? There's Noah, there's Abraham, Moses, Elijah, Joshua, David, several other names in addition. Do you know which individuals are named by him? How many of you would think Moses is in that list? Okay, I saw a few timid hands, okay? David being a man after God's own heart, how many would think he was in there? Okay. Now, I appreciate your bravery. I remembered what Mr. Stiver said. It's hard being on the receiving end of questions, especially when those questions leave some latitude. One of the men who was on that list was Noah. That seems to make sense. One of the men who was on that list was Job. That one makes a lot of sense also, considering the dialogue between God and Satan about, have you seen my man Job? So far we haven't found David. We haven't found Abraham. The third man on that list is Daniel. Three giants of the Bible. In Ezekiel 14, verses 14 and 20, both places, because he makes the same statement twice, he says, though Noah, Daniel, and Job were alive, they would not be able to spare anyone but themselves. It's interesting to see God pick these three individuals as giant examples of righteousness. What is remarkable about this account is that, well, what's the old saying? I was listening to a program here yesterday on the radio, entertaining myself as I was driving, and it was about a contemporary artist, a wildlife artist from the beginning of the 1900s, and they were interviewing the artist's granddaughter, and the granddaughter, as she was talking about her grandfather, said, you know, one of the real blessings in my grandfather's life is he acquired fame and the fortune that went along with it. He acquired fame and fortune while he was alive. You know, the world of art, the world of music, the world of talent in those areas is one where most great artists and most great symphonic composers were not famous until they were dead. Most people are not fully respected while they're alive. And so the inclusion of the name of Daniel in this list is even more extraordinary, because Daniel was younger than Ezekiel. They both lived in the same country. In 605 BC, Daniel was taken captive to Babylon. 8 years later, Ezekiel was taken captive to Babylon. Now, Daniel was taken to the city itself. Ezekiel, for those of you that know of his life, was to a colony on the river Kibar. They didn't go to the same areas. But 8 years apart, those two men were taken in different invasions of Judea. They were taken to Babylon as captives. Daniel was probably somewhere between 12 and 15 when he was taken captive. In 605, they think that Ezekiel was probably about 25 to 30, probably about 25. So Ezekiel was two or three years older than Daniel. If Ezekiel had been writing the book, it would have been very unusual for Ezekiel to say, well, you know, I know this guy. This guy and I are both fundamentally the same age. Well, what makes him so special? But Ezekiel didn't write Ezekiel. I mean in terms of inspire the writing. He wrote it, but he didn't inspire the writing. It was God who inspired the writing. And so as Ezekiel is sitting there writing down the names of three Old Testament giants, he wrote down the name of Noah. That was easy, I'm sure, for him to write down. And Job, I'm equally sure it was easy for him to write down. I wonder what must have gone through Ezekiel's mind when God said, and Daniel. It's like picking one of your neighbors that you know about, even if you don't know him personally. Well, it adds a certain status to Daniel that I think is very special. Of all the men in the Bible, now I'll be very personal, of all the men in the Bible, Daniel is my favorite. In fact, the title of this sermon, if you want a title, the Cybercast crew came up earlier and said, have you got a title for your sermon? Titles are not always easy. I said, yeah, I've got a title. Real easy. Daniel is my hero. So if you want a title, that's it. You know, there are many great people in the Bible, but they're not all cut out of the same fabric. As a minister, I have a tremendous respect for men and women who make major changes in their lives, who overcome tremendous problems, make 180-degree turnarounds in their life. I think all of us do. It's something to watch somebody treading down the road of life, realize that the way they're going is absolutely, totally wrong, do a 180 and start going in the opposite direction. To me, when I look at the Bible, the most outstanding example in all of the Bible of somebody on that path was the Apostle Paul. Here was a man with arrest warrants for members of the Church of God on the way to Damascus to make the arrest and bring them back for torture and probably death, who before he got to Damascus had a 180-degree turnaround and spent the rest of his life being persecuted by the very people that he had been working for. Now, that's a turnaround. Despite the admiration that I have for those people, they are in a category that is special, and I will always admire the specialness of their circumstance. There's also something special about the people in Daniel's category. There is something special about the life of a person that starts right, stays right, and ends right. And you know, the occasion we're having today is dedicated to young men and young women who grew up in this church, are in this church are progressing through their teenage years and into their young adulthood in this church. And so you're a special audience. By and large, those of you who are here for this activity are not individuals that came into this church from outside this church. You had the opportunity to start right. You're on a journey where our greatest desire is that you stay right. And there's no greater joy that any of us who are your elders or God Himself as your Lord has than to see you end right. And you know, in that environment, I don't know of a better role model than Daniel. I don't know of another human being in all of the Bible that stands as tall as Daniel does as a model for those of you who are here for this weekend's activity. You know, the Apostle Paul, when I go back and I contrast the two sides, the Apostle Paul, as beautiful and as phenomenal a man as he was, bared his heart in the letters that he wrote and said, you know, in essence what he said is, if I could do anything, I would do over my life. If I had known what I know now, I would have never done what I did. He said it in such ways as, I am not fit to be in the office that I'm in. But God placed me here, and so I will work as hard as anybody on the face of this earth to please God in the task He's given me to do. But you can tell by the words of Paul that if Paul had had a chance to be a Daniel, he would dearly have desired to be a Daniel instead of a Paul. I know you don't have to learn to appreciate the right way and to live the right way by having gone the wrong way. You know, there's a certain myth that circulates in some quarters. I don't think in the church, but there's a certain myth that I sense and I feel. It's almost as if I can't appreciate the good things in life without first of all having gone the other way. There is rejoicing in the Scripture at the return of the prodigal son. There is not rejoicing in Scripture that he was the prodigal son, and you do have to divide between the two. That he came back was a point of great celebration. That he was prodigal was not something to celebrate. As his brother, envious at the feast, said, I've been loyal to you all my life, Dad. You've never taken one of your prize animals, slaughtered him, and given me a feast. And his dad said, yeah, I know that. Your brother's come back, and I'm absolutely happy. He said, but you have to understand something. You still have your inheritance. You know, what he was saying is, this special feast is fundamentally what your brother's got, because he spent everything else he had. You still have everything that is yours. We sometimes miss those particular finer points in the description. We rejoice at the return of the prodigal son, but you know, we will never from the pulpit encourage people to be prodigals. It's not the right path. It's not the preferred path. That's probably the better way to say it. It isn't the preferred path. You know, Daniel is an interesting example of the fact that hard knocks is not the only school of spiritual learning. Nobody knows Daniel's exact age at the time he went captive. They know the ballpark simply because he was placed in a class of people that had an age range. He was put in a school of learning so that he could serve in the court of the king of Babylon. And he went through a 3-year education. Now, they know the age of the young men that usually were chosen for that task, and therefore they assume when Daniel went into captivity in 605 BC that on the young side he was 12, on the old side 15. So the likelihood is this boy, when he walked from Jerusalem to Babylon, was somewhere between 12 years old and 15 years old. Probably more likely on the younger side of that. And you know what? Based upon this 12 to 15 range, we know that Daniel, when he died of old age, was probably somewhere between about 81 and 85 years old. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie or read the book, The Man Without a Country. One of the speakers at the Feast in Bend used that as a basis for a sermonette this year. You know, Daniel was much like that. As a 12 to 15 year old, he walked away from Jerusalem, resettled in Babylon, and there's no record in the entirety of the rest of his life that he ever again saw his home. Just before he died, the king who was currently in office gave the decree to go and rebuild Jerusalem. Daniel probably lived one more year after that decree was given. Too old, too decrepit to be able to survive the journey from Babylon back to Jerusalem. The likelihood is he never again saw his home once he walked away from it as an early teenager. He spent the entirety of his life living in a foreign land as a subject of a foreign king, and he lived the entirety of that life from 12 or 13 to his early 80s as a righteous man. Daniel is one of those extremely rare people in the Bible who has not one solitary black mark on his personal biblical record. As you go through people's biblical records, I'm not sure who else you find in that same boat. You know, one of the giants, in fact, if I were to look at a giant in the New Testament, I would say the giant of the New Testament is John the Baptist. And I would say that on the weight of what Jesus Christ said when he said, "There is no more righteous man born of woman than John the Baptist." And yet, in the biblical account, because God does not veneer or varnish his heroes. He says, "Here they are. Here are my people, my men, my women." But you know, he tells you their clean laundry and their dirty laundry. And even John the Baptist, while he was in prison waiting to be beheaded, expressed certain concerns and certain questions about whether or not Christ was the Messiah, whether or not he was there to fulfill that particular function. You never see a waver. You never see a quaver. You never see a doubt. You never see any of that in the entirety of the record of Daniel's life. The Bible is full of the biographies of great people. Daniel, if not the only one, is among an extremely rare class of people about whom nothing negative is written. I ask you to begin with, if you didn't know whose names were in Ezekiel, who they might be. And I mentioned people like Moses, David, there's Abraham, Elijah, phenomenal people. And yet they all stumbled. Abraham, on more than one occasion, looked the man right square in the eye and made what he knew was a bald-faced lie. Now, it was a half-truth when they said, "Well, who is this beautiful babe that you've got with you?" And he said, "Oh, that's my sister." Well, yeah, for technical purposes, she was. She was his half-sister. But for the purposes that the king was asking, he was lying. Because what the king was asking was not, "Who is that?" but, "Can I marry that person?" And Abraham was saying, "You know what? If I say it's my wife and he wants her bad enough, he'll go ahead and take her, but the way he'll take her is he'll take her this way. Off will go my head. And I'd like to stay alive if somebody takes my wife, and so I'll say she's my sister. That way, if he's interested enough, he'll take her without killing me first." Now, this is not an honest transaction. And you read the biblical account, you know it. Moses made some mistakes. One mistake that he dearly, dearly regretted, a mistake that God said, "Moses, that mistake is going to cost you the opportunity to set foot on the promised land. You'll never touch it. I'll take you up to the top of Mount Nebo. I'll let you look across the valley. I'll let you see it. And then you're going to die. You're never going to touch it." with all the years and all the service and all the dedication that Moses spent in leading Israel out of Egypt, that had to be a tough, tough consequence. David, I don't need to go through his laundry list, and Mr. Stiver went through Elijah's laundry list, and so we've covered all of those individuals, as I said, who are giants of the Old Testament, all of them with their mistakes recorded. Daniel, though, as I said, is different. He is recorded as an exceptionally fine young man who became an exceptionally fine man who died an exceptionally fine old man. Daniel 9 and verse 23. You know what, if I could ask you as you're turning to Daniel chapter 9, what would you like to hear come out of God's mouth when he first meets you? Or better yet, when you first meet him, because he's met you, you just haven't met him. When the day comes that you can actually see God, what would you like God to say about you? I look at what God has said about a few people in the Bible, and you say, that's fantastic. I think we all nod our heads and we say, I can understand it when we hear in the New Testament God's voice saying about his son, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. And we say, well, it's wonderful to hear that, and it's what I would expect. It is nice to hear somebody record about David. These are not the words of God about David. It's somebody recording it said he was a man after God's own heart. Abraham was called a friend of God. These are beautiful, beautiful things to have said. In Daniel chapter 9, we get a chance to see what the angel of the Lord spoke to Daniel about how God felt about Daniel. In Daniel chapter 9 and verse 23, at the beginning, the angel Gabriel came to Daniel. Daniel had been praying with great fervency, and the angel Gabriel was sent to him to answer on God's behalf. And Gabriel said this, at the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I have come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved. Therefore, consider the matter and understand the vision. God sent to Daniel one of his greatest spirit beings. You know, it's something if the President of the United States, for instance, wanted to send a message to you, and he sent it by way of the Vice President, you would know that you were highly considered, wouldn't you? If he sent it by one of the office staff or one of the secretaries, or he sent a letter in the mail and you could see the secretary's initials at the bottom, you'd be impressed by having been addressed by the President. But there would be something impressive if Vice President Cheney knocked on your front door and said, Mr. Bush has sent me to deliver a message to you. Well, next to Jesus Christ, you get down into the archangels, and Gabriel is that third tier below the Father and his Son. And God said, from the minute you started talking to me, I commissioned Gabriel to come and give you an answer. That is not a common event. And he said, I want you to know that you are greatly beloved. You know what, brethren, there are very few people in the Bible where God addressed them in that particular fashion. There are only three or four that were ranked at that level in terms of what God said. And in all of those cases, God treated them in a way that was different than the way he treated other people. There was a kinship, there was an affinity, there was a friendship where God said, you know what, I feel free to say more to this person than I would say to people in general. Abraham was one of those individuals. You remember when God came to his tent and he was fed and he was on his way to Sodom, and he turned around after he left and he said, you know what, I can't leave this tent and this man and go to Sodom to investigate without first of all telling him why I'm here. God didn't owe Abraham anything. What he owed him what he owed him. And as I said, he didn't owe him anything. What he owed him was friendship. He said, this man is a friend. I will not come and do that business without first of all talking to him about what I'm here for and where I'm going. That's quite a privilege. That's quite a closeness. You know, the two most powerful blocks of end time prophetic events are found in the books of people who were called beloved. When you read the four Gospels, the last of those four Gospels is written by a man who talks about himself every so often, but he never uses his name. But he does use a title every once in a while. And as he refers to himself, he refers to himself as the disciple whom Christ loved. The disciple whom Christ loved. The one who sat right next to his elbow at the final Passover. The one who was so close to Christ as to make Peter jealous. When Christ said to Peter, Peter, what are you doing up here fishing? I called you to feed my sheep. And when he'd backed Peter far enough in a corner, he finally said, Peter, you're going to die the same way I did, as a way of learning the profoundness of the lessons. In his jealousy, because Peter was still very green and very carnal, when Christ told him how he would die, the first thing out of his mouth was, well, what about him? And he pointed at John. And Christ said, he's none of your business. Christ said, if he lives until I return, that's not your business. You go and do what I told you to do. That beloved of Christ was the one honored by receiving the book of Revelation. This beloved of Christ, of God, was the one given the visions of Daniel. There was only one other person who was addressed in the same terms as Daniel and John. And she was a woman. And that woman became the mother of Jesus Christ. Very, very rare place to be for God to say, I have deep honor for you. You are dearly beloved by me. Daniel was in that rare, rare category. In John chapter 17, John records the final prayer of Jesus Christ for his disciples. He made a comment about his disciples that fit so beautifully the life of Daniel. And that statement is this. In John 17, in his prayer, he said in verse 15, he said, I do not pray. This is God praying to his Father in the presence of his disciples. He said, Father, I do not pray that you should take these men, my disciples, my followers, the men in this room with me as we're taking the Passover. I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. And so, in this particular prayer, as he talked to his Father, he said, you know, as I define my disciples, I define these men as people who are in the world, but not of the world. And he said, I'm not asking you to take them out of the world. Just protect them while they're here. You know, Christ in this final prayer at his last Passover with his disciples said something about his disciples that described well the life of Daniel. Daniel lived his entire life, quote, in the world. Daniel had no family in the church. He didn't have a local Bible study to attend. He had no local congregation that he could fall back on support. There was no summer camp. There were no youth activities to remind him of what he believed. I'm not even sure he had a copy of the Bible as a young man. The only thing that we know that he did have was three good friends. All four of them willing to live by their religion, and to encourage each other to live by their religion. That's the only thing that we know that this 13 or 14-year-old boy had. Three other good friends. All four of them on the same channel. You know, it's tough to be 13 and no one to encourage you to stay true to your religion except three other teenage friends. There are some, I'm sure, in this room, in fact, I know there are some in this room, who have lived that same life, who have walked that same path. There are some in this room as teenagers who made a commitment to go this way of life who didn't have any other single human being in their life to encourage them. Now that's a hard life. That's a hard rut. I know what it feels like that much. Because at that particular age, when I decided to go this particular way, the only people I had for support were a mother and a father, but no church. At that time, I was living in southern Idaho, and this was the closest church back in the 50s. Daniel had it far harder than that. He didn't have any parents to help him out. He had simply Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Let's ratchet this up a notch, though, in regards to Daniel. He not only lived in the world, he lived in the most challenging part of it. How would you like it if somebody comes in and says, okay, we've just moved you into your new quarters, and we want to be sure you're comfortable. Here are your Godiva chocolates, your cherry cheesecake, and all the Ben and Jerry's ice cream you ever want. Just ring when you need more. And frankly, we want you to eat all of it you can because we want you to look real nice and well-rounded, and we want you to look real rosy and, by our definition, healthy. Now, how many of you here are going to say, hang on a minute. I really appreciate how much you're concerned about me. I don't need the Godiva chocolates. I don't need the cheesecake. I'm sorry, I don't do Ben and Jerry's. I would like broccoli, though. Now, I know how the average teenage mind in this room is working right now, and it's, and the cow jumped over the moon. You know, this is not going to happen. Now, I'm sure there were some hitches in all of this, so I've made it a little rosier than it is. I'm sure in the menu there were also things that you, just like Daniel, would say, I appreciate your concern, but those pork chops are really not on my menu. And I know you'd say that the same as Daniel. That's a nice-looking shrimp cocktail, but I'm sorry, I don't do shrimp cocktail. When you read Daniel chapter 1, the chief steward of the king of Babylon was responsible to see that these young men, selected for 3 years of schooling, were well-fed and that they looked good. And they had a Babylonian diet that was required. And these young men said, I'm sorry, I'm 14 and I'm not into wine. And I'm not into all of your rich food and I'm not into unclean meat. I do have a diet, and when the chief steward looked at the diet, he said, good grief. You know, if I feed you this, you're going to look pathetic, and when you look pathetic, I'm going to get killed. And Daniel simply said, look, let me eat something healthy, and you give me a few days, and you take a look at me. And if I don't look well, then let's talk it over again. And if you read Daniel chapter 1, verses 5 through 16, when that was over, the steward came back and said, well, you know what? You look all right. You're a fairly healthy-looking specimen. Go ahead and eat your diet. Now, it's really nasty because in Daniel it says his diet was vegetables. And it said what he was offered were all the delicacies of the king of Babylon, every fancy food that the king's chef could cook was offered. And he said, no, I'm more concerned about how healthy I am than whether or not I get all the junk food that you've got to offer me. As I said, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. As you continue through Daniel's life, Daniel from very early on was given considerable power. I don't expect most here, and I don't expect the teens and the young adults to understand what it's like to be in the midst of tremendous power. I will give you what I think most of us can understand best of all, and that is, you pick up any gossip sheet about personalities in sports or in media. And one of them I can think of automatically is every Sunday, if there's a parade supplement in your Sunday paper, you can open up to the inside cover, and there will always be little square pictures of Hollywood personalities or sports stars and little Q&A questions about them. The lives of people in Hollywood and in professional sports are absolutely full of the failure stories. Marriages that last for a year or two, five or six marriages down the line, finally getting life squared away enough where it can go somewhere. Drugs that are endemic, alcohol abuse that is also epidemic. The lives of countless people who will tell you 5, 10, 15 years down the road of abuse that I'm finally getting my head squared away, I'm finally getting my life back on track. What a mess I have made. The success, the glitter, the glamour, the money absolutely tears apart the lives of young men and young women in the world of professional sports and in media. Daniel came out of his schooling. Let's put him on the high end. He was 15 years old. 3 years of schooling, he's 18 years old. The king of Babylon has a dream, and he says to all of his wise men, I want both the dream and the interpretation, and if you don't give it to me, you're dead. Daniel ends up with the inspiration of God giving the king both the dream and the inspiration. And as a reward, the king makes Daniel the equivalent of a governor of a province. Now, what I don't know and what you don't know is how many years elapsed from graduation till Nebuchadnezzar's vision. We don't know. There's no reason to assume by looking at it that it was a great distance of time. And so here's a young man who's probably just in his late teens or early 20s, already serving as a governor of one of the states of the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. You begin to understand what I mean by in the world but not of the world? That's heady wine. That's a hard place to be. That's a tough road. Nebuchadnezzar finally died, and following his death, Belshazzar became the king. Belshazzar reigned during his particular point in time, and there came a day when Belshazzar called a feast of all of his dignitaries, and the great biblical event, which is referred to as the handwriting on the wall, took place. In the middle of the feast, a hand appeared and started writing on the wall. And of course, you can imagine how the king felt. This was before special effects, holograms, and all the rest. And hands just didn't appear and write on walls. And being very disturbed, he said, "What does it say?" And nobody knew. And his wife then gave an interesting comment. In Daniel chapter 5, his wife said, she said, "Dear, don't be worried." I'm reading from Daniel 5:11 if you want to follow me. He said, "There's a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God." Now, these people believed in all sorts of gods. "And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers, inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he'll give you the interpretation." You know what? This is years and years and years later. And this man's reputation is still, if you want an answer to these things, this man is a man who is just not like anyone else. Now, if you read the account in Daniel chapter 5, you will find that Daniel was offered by Belshazzar the equivalent of the office and the commission of being the captain of the Titanic. He said, if you will interpret the vision, and the vision interpretation was, you're dead, your kingdom's finished, and Babylon just went down the drain. That was the interpretation that he didn't yet know. And he said, if you'll tell me the interpretation, I'll make you the third most powerful person in this nation. Now, Daniel wasn't a cynic. He would have said, well, fat chance, I'll tell you, you're giving me the chance to be the captain of a sinking ship. And he said, you keep your office, I'll give you the answer to your vision. And the answer to the vision was, your kingdom is over. It's done. It's finished. Tonight is the end of it. Tomorrow, somebody else is going to be in office. Tomorrow, Darius the Mede was in office. And Darius the Mede looked over this country. You know, in the world of politics, especially the world of party politics, when a president comes in, all the offices that were around get swept out and somebody else gets to come in and take their place. If they're all Republicans, throw them out because we're Democrats. If they're all Democrats, throw them out and replace them with Republicans. Darius looked at what was there. He saw Daniel. He said, I've got 120 different states and a governor over each of them. And I have three individuals I want to be as my vice presidents watching over all 120 governors. And Daniel, you're one of them. Daniel lived successfully all through the reign of Darius. He was an uncompromising man. We all know the story of Daniel and the lion's den. The other governors said, we don't like him. Let's see if we can politic him out. We'll ask the king to make a decree that anybody that prays to anyone but him is dead. The king didn't know he had been set up. He made the decree. What did Daniel do? How politically correct was Daniel? The decree was signed. The decree was announced. Daniel went up to his room, opened his windows, knelt down, as he did three times a day, and prayed to God. And for that, they threw him in a lion's den. Daniel said, right is right, and I will do what is right if it kills me. And God respected that right phenomenally. Daniel lived all the way through the reign of Darius the king as a good friend. When Darius died, Cyrus took over the throne. As an old man in his 80s, Daniel only lived 1 year into Cyrus's reign before he died of old age, and yet highly respected even by Cyrus. As one Bible commentary said, I think very appropriately, Daniel's life was characterized by faith, prayer, courage, consistency, and lack of compromise. No wonder God called him greatly beloved. I have another 25 or 30 years to go before I reach the age that Daniel was at the end of Darius's life and the beginning of Cyrus's life. But I can tell you something. When I grow up, I want to be like Daniel.